You're listening to episode 20 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Yes, you heard that right. This is episode 20 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. So first of all, yes, my name is Klaatu. This is the GNU World Order. We talk about technology and computers, specifically POSIX, Unix, Linux, things like that. So in this episode, which is the season finale, of course, as I've said many times before, seasons are merely arbitrary blocks of time that I decided at one point would constitute a quote-unquote season of GNU World Order. It doesn't align with years or months or anything. It's completely arbitrary. It's 0 through 20, and sometimes 1 through 20 if I forget to do the 0th episode. First thing is first, and that is, of course, listener feedback. You know that by now. Listener feedback. I got some good listener feedback this time around. I mean, I often do, but this time I got some very notably good feedback, I guess because I was notably controversial in the previous episode. And by controversial, I mean I kind of said something that I wanted to discuss. I'm really happy that Steve is willing to discuss it. And he sent me an email about this thing, and he says he understands the frustration that me, Klaatu, and others, many others, feel about commercial interests leeching off of open source. And he feels that way himself, he says. But developing a, quote, com pay, unquote, and I think that's like commercial pay, probably, license, which says free as in beer to this user and not free to that user, is likely to throw the whole open source baby out with the commercial dirty bathwater. That's an interesting turn of phrase that he took, I thought. I'll keep reading because he makes some really interesting points that while, yeah, I could try to summarize them, we might as well just let him say it for himself. So he says, on the philosophical point that only open source advocates care about or for and about which commercial interests does not give a darn, I actually censored that. I'm sorry, Steve. Compay software would no longer be free or libre. We would be retreating from hard-won territory. We should not try playing the commercial interests at their own game. They are better at money-grubbing than we are. We would lose. And we have our own strengths in community, freedom, and openness. We include the whole of humanity, including those who can pay. So this is a very interesting point, I think. This is me, Klaatu, again, not Steve. That's a really, really great point. I mean, he exudes in his email here a very steadfast faith in the ideas of open source, you know, the community, freedom, and, you know, freedom as in $0, and openness as in having all the code out there, I think. Well, maybe freedom in both senses of the word, I don't know. I can't believe, you know, I looked this up one time, I looked for an adjective form of liberty, the word liberty, and there just isn't one in the English language. It just doesn't libertatious, you know, it just doesn't exist. Anyway, he makes a good point, and it's cool to hear him really just kind of stand by those ideas. He says, I want to consider what a compay license might mean. Code modifications made by commercial users would have a different status than code modifications made by non-commercial users. Or if the license said, no, the status of all code will be the same, then there would be no financial incentive for commercial interests to push any mods upstream. So compay software could evolve into something like open core, but with multiple cores centered at different, you know, like a corporation versus someone who's not having to pay. So he's got a great point there. It's just like the schema of something where you're forcing people to pay for stuff, I guess that does kind of get complex. He also says the introduction of commercial interests into the governance of open source projects would be corrosive. And he makes a great point there. I mean, that's a really good point. That's something I hadn't even thought of, to be honest. That's just not something that even crossed my mind. Compay would remove the in-your-face presence of free and libre software from the procurement decisions of commercial businesses. Then there would be no real choice between MS Office and LibreOffice other than which has the best features and lowest price tag. I hear him on this, and he mentions like the adoption of the Munich City council supposedly adopting open source, which, and I say supposedly because I'm not there and I'm not witnessing it myself, but that's what the news says. The British government adopted ODF as its document standard. All these little things. And he's got a point, and he says Steve Ballmer was right when he said that Linux is a cancer among proprietary software. And that's great. I love this stuff. On the other hand, I honestly, personally, and maybe I'm just not in this realm, so I don't see it, and so it's not real to me, but it feels a little bit like I don't really see that many people looking at the $0 price tag as an incentive. And this could be totally incorrect. This could be completely untrue. And it might be that, you know, in my world where it's, you know, up to 100 people at most, 100 licenses, yeah, that was never really an incentive for people. People just kind of think, you know, we'll it doesn't matter. Free and whatever the cost of 100 licenses of Microsoft Office would be, it's basically the same to us. Because we're more familiar with Microsoft Office, we don't want to have to retrain people or you know, let people retrain themselves on LibreOffice. And I you know, that might just be my perception, and at a much, much higher level where people are making big choices, like $100,000 or $1 million for some kind of, you know, industrial grade kind of like commercial thing of, for, you know, some kind of alternative to SSL, for instance. I mean, the fact that SSL got used and was being used in the way that it was used, that could have been really just because of the $0 price tag on it. And it just kind of started out as a cost-saving measure, and it just continued being that. And I guess maybe what Steve is saying, or not maybe, this is actually what he says. He says, this is him quoting, and this, I like this a lot. So, it is up to the community to raise the stakes. Start referring to, quote, contributors, end quote, and, quote, leeches, end quote. Promote enlightened self-interest in the business community. I know we won't convince them all. We can't and shouldn't try to force them if forcing means becoming the opposite of what we are. End quote. Really, really powerful words. I wish I had thought of that myself. And, yeah, I mean, Steve kind of sold me on this. I was a little bit ambivalent when I mentioned it. And I do feel like there's a responsibility out there. And I think a lot of us do feel like big businesses have a responsibility out there to, you know, to pay for what they're using in some sense. And to have the awareness that, okay, we're using this thing. We should probably make sure that the people creating it are taken care of. And they're not doing that. And that's stupid. But, I mean, like he says, it's up to the community, a lot of voices, to raise their voices. And yeah, start referring to people as contributors and leeches. And this is, I think, probably why Greg Croa Hartman does that little sort of report of the Linux kernel contributions every year, or every other year, however often he does that. And he looks at the companies, you know, and he sees, oh, okay, Red Hat has done, you know, 90% of the contributions, or, you know, corporate contributions, and I'm making up these numbers, I probably shouldn't do that. So Red Hat did X amount, Canonical did Y amount, you know, so-and-so did Z amount, and it becomes kind of, you know, I mean, it's out there. People are looking at you and they're judging you. And whether or not you respond to that or not as a company, that's, I guess, a different question. Anyway, either way, well said, Steve. Really, really well said. I feel like I've been a little bit enlightened by that analysis. And thank you. Thank you very much. So he says also, P.S. on parentheses and braces. In the UK, we refer to the round ones as brackets, curly ones as braces. There is no clear terminology for other shapes of linguistic containers. Parentheses has too many syllables for everyday discourse, which is no doubt why you keep saying round, curly, square, pointy, blah, 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 close, pointy, square, curly, round. Yes, that's pretty much true. I know the military in the U.S. abbreviates it and just says Paren, P-A-R-E-N. So you don't have to say parenthesis, you just say Paren, or close Paren. So yeah, that's really, really great. Thank you very much, Steve, for your feedback. Okay, let's see, who else has emailed me? So I don't know how to say this name, but it's kind of like Miguel or Miegel. I'm not really sure. Whoever this person is emailed me. I'd never heard of this person before, so it was really nice to get an email from a new person. And this person says, check Man Smart D, as in Delta, and mansmartd.conf for automatic smart checks. You can set machines up to mail you when smart control finds errors, but if you already use LogWatch, it will add smart errors found in syslog to its reports. That's fantastic. I emailed him or her back enthusiastically thanking this person because, I mean, that's just fantastic. That is really, really great news to hear. I did not know about SmartD. I didn't know about SmartD.conf. I didn't know about any of that stuff. So it's fantastic. So this is obviously in regards to talking about Smart. The other episode about how a hard drive of mine had failed. And, yeah, that's really, really fantastic news. I'm gonna start using SmartD. No question about it. It's a little bit crazy to me that it doesn't, you know, that it's not something that gets turned on at the beginning. I mean, like, you know, not to point fingers, but I mean, Fedora turns on SE Linux by default and doesn't give SmartD by default. I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer to me. I'm not really sure. Am I missing something? I still feel a little bit bewildered at how something so significant and important, and once again, not really something that I see in other OSs either. This should be a default setting, I feel. I mean, am I wrong? Am I missing something? Am I not remembering something? I mean, this should absolutely be something. This is kind of a killer feature of Linux. If you use Linux, you'll get an email before your hard drive dies, potentially. Still back up, but it might be able to detect when your hard drive fails. Whereas other operating systems, at least as far as I know, I've never heard of anything like that on certainly my old operating system. It's weird to even say that it's my old operating system at this point. It's been such a long time now that I can barely even think of myself as a former other operating system user. Anyway, on to the next email. This email, the last email that I got that I'll read today, is from, I think, no, that's not true, the second to last, is from Lord Drakenblut, who had emailed me previously about Sphinx, the Python documentation tool, and he mentions that there's something called Breathe, B-R-E-A-T-H-E, which bridges Doxygen with Sphinx. And I found out that I think we actually use that at work. I had not heard of it or been aware of it, but apparently it is actually in use behind all the scenes at work. So, cool. It's a great resource to know about if you're developing something and writing documentation. Your API, of course, can be auto-documented, more or less, with Doxygen. And then you've got your user docs that you're doing in Sphinx, and you can marry them together with one simple makefile that'll trigger a whole big build with this thing called Breathe. So, check that out. Finally, I've got an email from Doug. And Doug, of course, is the Python guy. We all know him by now, I think. And he says, yes, you can do the opening and reading and writing of files as described in the previous episode. And he also mentions that there's this really great way of dealing with errors when you're, you know, trying to write out a file and so on. And this is a good point, because there are times where there could be, you know, you could be trying to write or read or whatever from a file, and it turns out that the file is on a disk that has been ejected or unmounted, or a network location that is no longer there. You know, maybe the server went down or something, or you lost a connection. So if you don't have if you don't tell Python to you know what to do if there is an error, Python will simply give you the error. You know, it'll basically crash. I mean, to the user, it's going to seem like a crash. I mean, I guess it is a crash. I don't feel like it's a crash because it's not really crashing. It's just it's following your instructions, and you didn't give it any instructions about what to do if it cannot find that file. So, and this is something that's very, very important to know for a lot of different tasks. And there's this thing in Python called try and accept. Not accept, but accept, like an exception. So try and accept is a great thing. I've used it a couple of times, especially now that there's PyQt and there's PySide. There's these two different GUI interfaces for Qt or Qt and Python. And to try to make some of the things that I was writing a little bit more flexible, I tried to put a try and accept import statement at the top of my application because I want to be able to tell Python to try to load or to import PyQt. If that doesn't work, then try PySide, and then if that fails, do something else. So, I didn't know about this, though. Doug is telling me something new here. So there's try and finally. So he says, try f equals open some file text r for line in f, you know, do some stuff, and then finally colon f dot close paren paren, or brace brace, whatever it's called. So, or bracket bracket, I don't know. See, I'm already confused. But anyway, so this uses Python's exception handling to make sure the file is closed, helping to keep it from getting corrupted. Should there be an exception thrown while processing the file, the finally clause of the try block will always run whether the code in the try block succeeds or not. I think that's really, really important. I did not know about that. I think it's really, really great to know about files because, as I've often said, and as I will not stop saying, the most important thing in computing is the user's data. I don't care what anyone else tells you or believes. I really believe that. The user's data is the most sacred thing that you have. And if you screw up their data, then it's really, really, I mean, there's like a, you know, there's a burden. There's a moral burden upon you. And I know that the user should always back up their data and all that stuff. But really, as programmers, you have to make sure that you're protecting the user from, you know, accidental deletion or corrupted files or anything like that. You screw up someone's data and if that user is smart, they will never touch your program again. And that's how I feel about it. I mean, that is one of the main reasons I ever got into Linux was because other operating systems did not, well, I have to be fair, another operating system that I used at that time did not respect my data in the least. And that was really one of the main reasons I got into Linux. So, yeah, definitely protect your user's data. So the finally block is really, really important and helpful and good to know about. There's another way to handle this, which is Doug speaking again, with context managers. Here is the same pattern using Python with statement. And he says, with open paren some file dot text comma r, close paren as in file colon indent for line in file blah blah blah. In this code, there is no explicit try except finally coding. The with statement takes advantage of the context manager associated with file objects. So when the with block scope denoted by the colon after infile ends, the file is closed, exception or not. I have used this before, this with open blah 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 as infile colon indent for line in infile processing processing processing. I did not know why I was using it. It was just a sample that I had found online. I thought, well, that seems like a nifty way to do it. And I've used it. And yeah, I had no problem with it. I didn't know that it was so good to use. And now I see that it is. And I know why. And now you do too. So look that up sometime. With open paren some file comma r or, you know, rw or whatever you're doing, close paren as in file colon and then indent and then for line and in file or whatever you want to do with that file. And that closes it no matter what at the end. So that's very good to know. And finally, Doug says a little bit about JSON, and I don't know if there's anything hugely significant in this, but I mean, he says, for instance, I mean, yes, it is becoming very popular. It's pretty easy to understand without too much effort, he says. I mean, I agree with that, but I also think that XML is pretty easy to understand, so there's that. But he says, and this is a good point, it's far shorter than the equivalent XML, and that is true. It is, XML is, you know, an XML file sitting next to a JSON file containing the same, you know, the same data would probably be like a good, I don't know, I guess I should talk in percentages, 5% larger, maybe? I don't know, 10%? 20%? I mean, XML, you got all your tags, and they all have to open and they all have to close, and a lot of the tags, you know, quite often they're not short tags. It's not like HTML where you have like P and div and UL and OL. XML, a lot of XML, not all, but I mean, a lot of XML schemas out there, they're pretty verbose. They don't care. So there's that. I mean, you can gzip it anyway, but anyway, I mean, yeah, XML does tend to be a little bit more heavy. And he says that it's probably, most importantly, he says it's becoming the de facto standard format for data being sent back and forth between web client, JavaScript, and servers. So it's trivial to turn a JSON string to a JavaScript object, especially if you're using something like jQuery, and with import JSON in Python, the same holds true there. So the point is that it's getting a little bit of, I guess the, you know, the brain share in a lot of different circles, which, I mean, the first I'd heard of JSON, at least as far as I can recall, was in a MongoDB presentation at, what was it called? Tech Conference Pittsburgh, I think is what it was called. And yeah, it did. It MongoDB uses it quite heavily. And when I saw it, I thought it was, I kind of thought it was cool. I thought, well, that is pretty simple to understand and grasp. And sure enough, it's not that hard once you kind of get the feel for it. And like I say, once you start using it within Python, you do see some of the advantages because it just kind of imports and dumps itself into sort of a Python dictionary-like object, and you're good to go. That's all the listener feedback for this episode. Let's move on. I'm sorry I lied. Actually, I didn't lie. That is all the listener feedback, but I don't want to move on yet. I want to go back to the paying for software thing. I have a feeling that this problem has actually already been solved, and I've just forgotten, and that is support. It's always about paying for support. That's been something that I've heard before, and I keep thinking it, and I sometimes forget that it exists, but I think in part because it's not enforced that someone pays for support. I have had the fortune of working for companies in the past, two companies now, that have very, very, I mean, it's part of their business model to pay for support. They have even called up developers directly and said, hey, we're using this library or this application or whatever. We want to pay you to, you know, we want to contract you to write some more code into your library or on top of your library or whatever. Can you do that? How much will it take? Etc. And they have built and are building, one of the companies that I work for now is doing this. You know, they have relationships with these developers and they're paying for stuff that they need, for little fixes that they need. They could do the fixes themselves or they could pay someone, the main developer, to write the code for them because that developer knows the code base better and might be able to do it quicker and so on. So it exists out there. Obviously, some companies like Red Hat have the entire, that is their business model. You know, just you're paying for the support. So it's there, it exists. It's just not necessarily enforced. And I think, as a word of advice to people out there who might be involved in IT, infrastructure, development, whatever, if you are asked by a higher up, hey, how should we do this? Or can we solve this problem? I think a lot of us, and when I say us, I mean me, and I'm kind of assuming that you, dear listener, are somewhat similar to me, because I do think that this is a community-wide thing, not 100%, but I mean, I think a lot of us, many of us, it's built into our, into either our DNA or we've been trained this way from, you know, this is the way I avoid being bullied at school or whatever. We're solution people. We find solutions. We make things possible. We hack things together until the impossible becomes possible. So when someone comes to us and says, "Hey, our budget is $0. What can we do?" We make that happen. We dive into the dumpster. We rescue the hardware. We put some free software on there. We build up a network, and it's literally taken, you know, $0. Aside from time and effort. And I think that obviously that's a great attribute to have, but I think in some cases it can be taken advantage of, and that's what we have to watch out for. Not only for ourselves, but also for the projects that we care about as a community or as users. You know, if there's something, and I've told this story before too, and I hope I don't belabor it, but it's one of those stories that I kind of have to keep remembering for myself because it's something that I should have started doing a long time ago. And that was that an employer did come to me and say, "Okay, we have $0. What can we do about this problem?" And in, you know, months ago, weeks ago, prior to that time, that one instance, I would have said, "Okay, here's a little free software that we can install and it'll make the problem go away." And instead I said, "Okay, here's a $100 piece of software that we could install, and that'll make the problem go away." And they heard $100, and where they said they had $0 before, they heard $100, the problem's gonna go away. It was worth it for them to pay $100 for the problem to go away. And so the donation was made to the project, the software was installed on, you know, over 100 computers, so it was like $1, you know, a seat. So it was well worth it. And I you know, they could have gotten it for $0, but that wasn't quote unquote the right thing to do. And sometimes the right thing versus can we download it and install it legally are two different things. And I think that a lot of times as people driven by finding solutions, we kind of skim over the part that has us looking out for the developers and making sure that support is being purchased, even if it's just in the form of a $100 donation. And that's really where I think the burden of all that donation should lie, is with the companies, the big corporations. Because honestly, I mean, if we were just writing software for each other, which, I mean, really we are, then there wouldn't need to be any money exchanging hands. We could all just kind of barter for all of this stuff, and it would probably even out in the end. But what happens is that very large companies are using these things, and so it takes the people who are installing the software, you know, the experts, us, we have to kind of step in, I think, and say, "Okay, well, we can install this thing, but we need to give, you know, we need to pay for some kind of license or some kind of support and make that happen." And that's not a 100% type of thing. I mean, sometimes you can just install something for free because it's free. But I think it's something to consider. Are you going to pay for support or aren't you? And I think that is all I have to say on the subject for now. Let's move on. Okay, first and foremost, and I think vaguely exciting, is the new version of Slacker Media is more or less out. And when I say the new version of Slacker Media, I really only mean the website and a couple of little things on top of the website that I've added. Slacker Media, as you may or may not know, is my, what I call a distro from text, which really means that it's not a distro at all. It's a book on how to configure Slack Slackware specifically, so that it is a digital studios. It's your multimedia creation suite. That's all it is, really. It's not a distribution. It's not a spin. It's not a remix. It's a text online, or if you want to buy a copy, you can do that, or download a copy, whatever. It's a text that says here, take Slackware as it is distributed from Patrick Volkerding and his team, and then install a bunch of other stuff, and here's how all that stuff fits together. For a very long time, I've been trying to figure out how exactly to tell people how it all fits together, because that's the real issue, right? You've got Slackware, Linux, or Linux in general, even if we want to make it really broad, and you're showing it to people. There's, I think, about four different things that, let's say, get in the way of understanding all of this stuff. The first thing is the install. Installing it is going to be difficult, and as I've said, and as many other people have said before in the past, no one installs operating systems, like, out in the world. We do, we all do, but real people don't install operating systems. You'd be shocked at how few people install an operating system, and you'd be further shocked at how few people install an operating system from nothing. You know, I mean, the number of people who build their PC and it doesn't have an OS on it and they install it from scratch, it's just a handful of people. And then, you know, you've got a couple of more, that's the low end. You've got a couple of people, you've got another segment of people, not many, on top of that, who get a computer and dare upgrade their operating system. And then there's everyone else who, they get a computer, it's already got the operating system on it, they never upgrade, they just buy a new computer when it comes out. That's a huge number of people. So installing is not going to be, that's something that there's, it's useless to pursue the whole installing thing. If people can't get past the fact that they have to install Linux, then that's just that. I mean, we can offer to install it for them. We can offer to sell them things from System76 or Zareason, and they're perfectly fine computers from those places. Actually, I shouldn't say perfectly fine. They're actually quite nice. A friend of mine got a System76, and it is a really nice machine. It's Galapago, or I forget what it's, Gazelle, I think it's Gazelle. Anyway, it's really nice. So yeah, installing, I mean, that's really out of our hands, I guess. I mean, you can't type on the internet and try to convince people that installing it is going to be easy, because it's just so far out of people's realm of reality. That's a thing. So installing the OS is one thing. Understanding the OS is another thing. People have to they have to get all their preconceptions out of their head, because obviously if you come to Linux expecting it to be exactly like OS X or Windows, it's a fruitless effort to try to make Linux those things. I mean, believe me, I'm all for the OS X skins and the Windows XP skins and all these other things that people do, and I do think that that makes it a little bit gentler in some ways, but I think that it's one of those, I'm sure there's a term for it, but it's just one of those things where, like, everything is fine, and it's the things that aren't fine that are sort of the deal breakers. You know, you can show people, look, it's exactly like your old OS, it's got this thing and it's got that thing. The minute something out of the ordinary happens that is unlike their OS, that's when it just blows up. That becomes the deal breaker. Sometimes it's like, oh, it didn't do this one thing that I expected, therefore Linux is too hard, I can't stand it, you know. So it's understanding the OS, that's a big struggle as well. So I'm assuming that we can get past the installing question, I'm assuming that we can get past the understanding the OS, the underlying OS problem, and then we arrive at, you know, if you're past those two things, then you're at the level of where you would need to be to use Slacker Media, or Slackware for that matter. Well, Slackware, you can get to know the OS on Slackware. Well, and installing. So what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that Slacker Media is not about convincing people to install Linux. It's not about convincing people that Linux is an okay thing. It's assuming that you're past those speed bumps and that you're ready to use Linux. So the real blockade for people trying to create content, you know, multimedia content on Linux is two things. It's learning the applications, because obviously if you went to school for film and you learned this video editor, then coming to Linux and suddenly realizing that the video editor you have there is completely different, that's that's going to hold you up for a long time, possibly. That's really going to stop your production. So that's difficult to overcome. It's not impossible by any means, but it is something that people are going to experience. And then the other thing, and this is, I think, in my mind, almost, well, it's as big, if not bigger, than learning the applications themselves. I guess it's just as big. But it's the workflow. It's the way that things fit together. And that's a big deal, and I don't know how equivalent it is outside of the world of multimedia. I mean, I don't know what people do with computers other than, like, programming. And that's really it. Programming and multimedia, as far as I know, that's what people do with computers. But I know that some people do other things with computers. I don't know what those things are. I don't know if that takes, if things fit together and talk to each other or what. You know, I don't know if you're doing like a spreadsheet and then you send it over to something else and then you send it back to some, you know, I don't know how that happens. I don't know what the expectations are there. But for multimedia, typically, you know, you have a certain set of applications that kind of talk to each other, or you know, the output of one application you're going to take into another to do the effects, and then you're going to send it back out for the audio mix or whatever. So it's the workflow or the pipeline, however you want to refer to it. And that's the part that when you come to Linux, you know, there's all these great applications, and there's quite frequently five or six of the same kinds of applications, and none of them do this other thing that you need, and then there's this other thing that you need, and there's five or six of those, and no one tells you how it's all supposed to go together, how it fits together. So for the new Slacker Media, the new Workflow Edition is what I call it, and you can see this at slackermedia.info online. The right-hand tab on the internet site of slackermedia.info is called Workflows, and if you click on that, you'll see a collection of infographics, because I know infographics are really popular right now. People like infographics because it doesn't have a lot of words. It has pictures and lines and drawings, and that's what I've got here. And it's a set of workflows for all the different kinds of art projects that I could think of. So you've got things like all-in-one music production. You've got audio production simplified. You've got audio production advanced. You've got audio and MIDI production. You've got video editing advanced. All-in-one video editing. Animation, 3D animation, visual effects, digital darkroom and photography, publishing and layout, writing and typesetting, all different kinds of things that typically, other than the all-in-ones, which are sort of obviously kind of all-in-one, typically they involve more than one application. And actually, even the music production all-in-one, that's deceptively titled because it's actually, there's an optional outboard component. But the point is that if you look at these infographics, it tells you in pretty clear terms what applications are going to be involved in a certain project that you want to undertake. Probably a really good example, and this is, well, okay, let me do a simple example first, okay? Video editing all in one. That's really simple. You launch Kden Live and you edit video. Now, that process is going to render two different things. One is a Kden Live project file. That's the file that contains, you know, the edits and the cuts and the decisions that you make. This is the file that you open up in Kden Live. And then, of course, there's the rendered file, the actual movie, the thing that you distribute to your audience, because obviously you're not going to send them a Caden Live file, right? You send the theater or your fans or YouTube or whatever wherever this thing is going, you send it an MP4 or a WebM or whatever you choose to send, XVID, whatever. So that's a very simple workflow, and its infographic is appropriately as simple as that. And it does, it tells you a little bit more. It gives you a little bit more information, like, okay, you're gonna have this effects engine that is gonna talk to Caden Live. There's gonna be your video files coming off your SD card. You might have some sound files coming in from someplace. And then you've got a rendering engine, an MLT and an FFmpeg, thing to spit out your render. So it gives you a little bit of information about what exactly, you know, the different components are. But essentially it's one thing, it's one box, whatever. Now, then there are other things, for instance, probably the most complex one I can think of off the top of my head, maybe, is, for instance, Qtractor, digital audio production with audio and MIDI. So you would have, you know, Qtractor itself, which in Qtractor, you've got a session file, which is obviously, again, what you open up when you start Qtractor. Branching out of your session files, however, if you're doing MIDI, you've actually got individual MIDI files that are represented by each little MIDI region in Qtractor. So you've got those that you have to keep track of. You've got QJack Control that you launched to keep track of all of your time and you know, your beats per minute and stuff like that. Now, QJack is an interesting beast because it's its own little program. And it's actually quite powerful, as many people have often said. And as such, it's got files sort of all of its own that you could save out to keep track of your sessions, depending on how complex your stuff is. Now, I mean, I've launched QJack Control and Qtractor, and that's been my entire production workflow. That's it. That's all I do. I mean, I plug in some audio, I generate some MIDI, done. But it can get more complex. So going down that path, in QJack Control, you can create your own patch bays so that you can track what is plugged into what. Like, I've got this outboard synthesizer and I want that plugged into my MIDI, or I want my MIDI controller, my physical keyboard controller, to be talking to that synth. So I'm going to make a connection there. So all these connections and well, outputs of sound and inputs, that can be saved as a patch bay session. So that's that. And then there's a QJack Control session file, which again records exactly what tools are being used during the session. Which synthesizers have you got opened up? What effects do you have active and so on? So that when you know, even 2 weeks from the time that you start the project and you come back to it to finish it, and you're thinking, okay, well, you know, which effects did I have open in Jack, and which ones were included in Qtractor? You know, you've got a lot to think of. So those things can be recorded. And then you've got all your outboard stuff that you could possibly have. And I say outboard meaning outboard from Qtractor. I don't actually mean physical hardware. So you've got Linux Sampler, for instance. Maybe you want to use samples. So you could plug that into QJack Control, and that'll become wrapped up into your session and patch bays. And obviously it's being piped into Qtractor as a sound source. You've got JackRack, which can keep track. You can have a session file for JackRack, and it can keep track of all the different effects that you have opened up. It's an effects host. You've got soft synths, any number of soft synths. I mean, you could have QSynth, you could have AmSynth, you could have what's the big one? Zen Sub Add Effects Synth. All those different things, and again, you can record which ones you're actually using in your QJack session. But you may also, if you're designing your own sounds, you're going to have custom patches, so you need to save those as files. So you've literally got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different kinds of file, like session files, that you can generate from a complex Qtractor experience. And that's not even including the final bounced track, like the the WAV file or the AUG file or the FLAC file that you export once you're finished and you want to put it onto a CD or you want to put it into your done folder and then upload it to Bandcamp or whatever. So, I mean, that's 8 file formats right there that you can generate with QTractor. And that's, believe it or not, that's not uncommon. Like, you might think, well, I know people who do music on, you know, this other OS and it's not nearly as complicated as that. Well, then you're probably looking for the all-in-one music production, which involves opening up LMMS, Linux Multimedia Studio, and playing your heart out. That's it. That's all you need. You can plug in as many sound fonts and sound files and samples as you want. You could even, if you're really daring, open up an external drum machine like Hydrogen, although that's not necessary because you can also do drum sequencing within LMMS. And you've got two files. You've got the LMMS project file and you've got the final bounced track. And that's standard. You cannot make it simpler than that. That is as simple as it gets. So, it doesn't have to be complex, but it can be complex. And believe me, some people do. On other OSs, music production can be that complex. Video, you know, visual effects on Linux is very complex. You've got, obviously, Blender generating a bunch of the assets and the particles and things. And you've got, of course, GIMP doing all your textures and texture maps and mats. You could use Krita and MyPaint for those things as well. You could use Inkscape. You could combine all that stuff back into Blender and then send it out via either Cycles or LuxRender or just Blender Render or PavRay or Mitsuba or any number of rendering technologies. And then you could take those back into Kden Live and composite them into your shot, or you could do the compositing in Blender and then take it out to Kden Live to integrate it into the rest of your movie. And that doesn't even count the sound stuff that you need to do to get your audio mix right. So yes, it can be very, very complex. And that's normal. And it doesn't have to be complex, and that's normal too. It just really depends on the level of the user and what exactly they're in for. The thing is that someone has to understand this stuff. Someone has to delineate it. Someone has to explain it for the user. And that is, I believe, what Slacker Media, the Workflow Edition, has done. So if you have a friend looking at Linux for multimedia work, and you don't know what to tell them, and they don't know what they're looking at, and all they see when they type in, how do I make a movie on Linux, or how do I do music on Linux, all they see are, like, you know, 8 different things and a thread about a flame war debating whether Ardour or QTractor is the better choice, then send them to Slacker Media and tell them to click on the Workflows button. They can also download the workflow sheets, the infographics themselves, as a PDF from the Downloads section. Yes, you can. I just checked. So they can do that, and that should clarify a lot for them. Now, the other thing, as you might imagine, with something like, for instance, this QTractor example that I gave you, or even the visual effects one, where you've got like 8 different file formats that you're generating from one day in the studio, and then you still have to render your file out. With that kind of workflow, you're generating a lot of files. And as long as you're in the moment, you can keep track of all that stuff, maybe, if you've got a brain like that. But, I mean, if you walk away from this for a month, much less for 3, 8, 10 years, and then come back, and you're like, oh, I really should fire up, you know, I should take a look at that old movie that I was working on, and or that I finished, but now I want to come out with a director's cut. Or I should open up that album I made that one time, because I really think I could mix it better. I didn't know anything about mixing and mastering back then, but I think I could redo it now. So you open that stuff up. I mean, just forget about trying to, it's a reverse engineer process, you know? It's like, oh man, where did I put that one video clip that I used in the movie? And where did I put, you know, what effect did I use in this song? And so on. Because I think many of us have been trained that when you open up a quote-unquote user-friendly application, you know, like a word processor. Word processor by its self-professed purpose is to process words. But a lot of people and, you know, a lot of applications that do word processing, they make it possible to drop pictures into your word processing document, which, I mean, really, strictly speaking, is not word processing. It's page layout or desktop publishing or whatever you want to call it. So it's the wrong place, but for convenience, it does happen. Now, what happens is that people will drag a picture into their word processing document, and certain companies have that picture just sort of invisibly, magically float right into the word processing document. And you don't know, as a technical user, did that picture just get recorded and saved into that word processing document? Did my 300 kilobyte file just become 3.3 megabytes because I put a picture into it? Or is it still 300 kilobytes and it's just referencing the picture off of my hard drive? Well, I don't know half the time. And the application, sadly, because it's so quote-unquote user-friendly, it doesn't tell the user what's going on. And so a lot of us have become, and this goes back to kind of, you know, not knowing how our applications work or how the underlying OS works, a lot of us just assume that if you put some asset into some application, then that application absorbs that asset. It makes a copy of that asset and puts it into a local place. That is not always the case. And with a lot of multimedia stuff, it's quite often not the case. Inkscape happily actually asks you, it says, do you want to embed this bitmap that you've just dragged into an Inkscape thing, or do you want to just link to it? KdenLive does not ask you, it always links. Your KdenLive file is an XML file that's human readable. It's never going to incorporate video clips into it, or you'd have like an 800 gig large file, which is silly. Music programs, generally speaking, do not absorb your assets. So it's something to consider. And what often happens is that 8 years down the line, you go back to an art project and you have no idea where half the stuff that it needs to open and function, where those things are located anymore. You don't even know if you have them anymore. They might be on some old backup drive somewhere at the bottom of your closet, but who knows? And even if you find them, then how do you reconstruct the paths, the file paths, that that application is going to need so that it can find all of that stuff? And some applications like KdenLive, I mean, it'll help you do that, but it's not how you want to spend an afternoon, honestly. That's just assuming that you can keep track of it all as you're going. Like, I mean, really, on some projects, you need to have that all figured out while you're working on it. You know, trying to keep track of it as you go just isn't going to work because it'll be that big, that much to think about. So to address that problem, I've developed a very simple little Python application called Planter. And it's a planter because you're planting a project. It's a seed of a project. So the idea is that you launch Planter. And Planter really is just it's makedir-p, except it's glorified. And the reason that I did Planter was because I figured there needs to be, for a lot of artists, I'm not saying everyone, but honestly, for a lot of artists, there needs to be a template of what a project directory is going to look like. Especially since on Linux, I have yet to see an application. I think maybe like OpenShot or something like that. Maybe it was PyTV or PyTV, whatever. One of those actually did, but very, very few applications. An Ardour does it. But anyway, as I'm trying to say, very few applications enforce this idea of, hi, I see that you've opened this application. I see that you're about to work on something that contains no data. Why don't we save it somewhere? Why don't we set up, you know, a location for all of your data? And I think that's a dangerous precedence. And I understand, I guess, sort of why an application... Actually, I don't understand. I think that an application, especially a creative one, where you know that there are going to be lots of different assets, I think that when you open it, it should be empty. You should have to manually create a new empty project. And when you do that, it should enforce upon you the idea that you need to save that into some place. And it's okay that they don't, because it does give freedom to people who, you know, don't want to have to do that every time they open up the application, which I can kind of understand. But for in-production artists, I think that's dangerous. And what happens is that you open something up and you start working, and then you say, oh yeah, I need to save this. And so you save it somewhere, and you don't really think about how this project is going to grow organically from scratch. So Planter does that for you. So when you launch Planter, it's a GUI and a shell-based application. You can do it either of those two ways. But when you launch it, you can either have the GUI prompt you, or you can do it in the shell. You create a location for your project directory and a location for any shared assets. And from that information, it creates a whole directory tree that includes things like, well, first the project, that's the top level, and then under that or above that, however you look at trees, I guess, there are general categories like audio, video, graphics, production, story, things like that. And then within each of those folders, there are folders relating to those kinds of activities. So in graphics, you might have posters, or I'm just making it up now because I don't remember, but poster, or marketing maybe, textures, paint, matte paintings, whatever. Under video, you might have, video files and proxies. Under audio, you might have samples, sound fonts, audio files, and so on. So you've got all these different folders. And I realize that for, you know, if you're a musician, then the video folder is extraneous. You will never ostensibly use the video folder. And I think that as an artist, you may as well just deal with that and take the directory, because on Linux, directories come for free. They don't really take up any space on your hard drive. And you never really know when, you know, even though you think, okay, I'm just creating a song. It's not going to be, it's just a little ditty. So you put together a song and you've got this project tree with all these extraneous directories in it that you're ignoring for the time being. But all of your assets are getting saved into this project directory. Now that you have to do manually, obviously. LMMS isn't going to just magically save everything into your project directory for you. You know, I mean, it's not that low level of a program. But I mean, having it there makes it a lot easier to categorize things and make sure that you are collecting all of your assets and putting them, putting copies of them into your directory tree. And then later on you think, well, wow, that song actually came together really nicely, and I've got my friend over here who's a budding videographer. I should have them help me make a music video. And so you come together and you make a video. And so now you do have a purpose for that video, even though you swore you'd never use it. So I don't think it's a bad thing to have more directories than you think you're going to need. And it certainly will help most artists keep things organized. And ideally, your whole project should be more or less self-contained within that one directory, you know, that one project directory. To the point that you should be able to take that one project directory and put it onto an archive hard drive, stash that hard drive in your closet, and in a year, you should be able to come back, plug that hard drive in, and have everything that you need for that project to work on that hard drive, give or take maybe one or two things. And those one or two things would be, first of all, shared assets. So all musicians, all artists, all video artists, all painters, whatever, any digital artist is going to have a set of shared assets. You're going to either have a set of sound fonts that you use across a bunch of different projects, or you're going to have a set of video clips, some stock footage that you might use, or maybe you don't, but you'll have video effects, certainly, that you don't package up with your project. It's just the video effect library that came on your computer. You might have brushes, a special paintbrush tips digitally that you use on, you know, Krita or GIMP or MyPaint or whatever. You know, all fonts probably everyone uses, a font, and that's not you may not take that font and put it into the project, although it wouldn't be a horrible idea, but if you're organized you wouldn't have to, because the theory is that you will have a set of shared assets, and you will have that placed somewhere on your computer and backed up so that you can access it now and in the future. Now, in a big production environment, of course, they have networked drives and they have shared assets that all the different departments can access, and that's what that is. If for the individual artists, sometimes it becomes a little bit more difficult, but that's hopefully what Planter encourages people to do, is say, hey, take all of your shared assets, all of the things that you're going to use across a lot of your different projects, and place them in a folder somewhere on your hard drive. Me personally, Klaatu, puts them on /user/local/share/artkit. That's where I put my shared assets. That's where they go. It's where they go on all of my, any computer that I set up is going to have that folder in it with the same set of assets. It's going to have my sound fonts and my normal fonts and my, some textures and a big set of brushes and just a bunch of things like that. And that's, they live there, and that's just where they go, and I always know that they'll be there. And they're on backup drives, so I've got them. I've got them many times over, but they don't need to be copied into every single project that I ever work on, because they're in my shared folder. So that's the idea behind the Planter shared folder thing, is that when you create a directory tree for a project, it symlinks certain directories in there, like the fonts directory, whether that fonts directory is appearing in the graphics folder or the marketing folder or whatever, I don't know, then it or the video folder, let's say, or the web folder, whatever. It's all linking back to your common font folder, and so on. So that's what Planter is all about. It's about helping the artist organize their work. And this is what workflow is all about. It's helping the artist understand how all of the many different components that Linux has to offer actually fit together into a coherent, artistic, and creative environment. So that's slackermedia.info. It's a complete redesign. I think it's a lot more friendly looking. It's a lot more hip and trendy and sort of like artist friendly, which, you know, between you and me, it's kind of silly, but I mean, really, my old design was like slackware.com, except with Slacker Media stuff on it, and that was very intentional and it was very geeky, but it's not the geeks I need to attract, right? It's the artists. So this is a very artsy kind of like modern thing. It's got infographics with lots of pictures. It's got Planter for people to help themselves organize their projects, and I'll update the book very soon. I've been meaning to have it updated by now, but I've been busy, and so the book itself is basically the same old text as always. But I mean, I'm not panicking because it's still all very relevant, but I do want to update it with more stuff about workflow and stuff like that. So check it out, refer your friends. It's something that I've been working on, and I hope it's helpful. Well, it sounds like it's time for a cup of coffee, and it's much deserved because we've been talking and listening, respectively, for about an hour, so let's go get a cup of coffee, and then let's keep talking and listening. This past week or so, actually, I guess almost 3 weeks ago now, I decided that I wanted to, in an effort to keep up with various things happening in the Linux world, I decided I was going to purchase a Red Hat license so that I could install RHEL 7, which came out not too long ago. And, I mean, it's probably been a couple of months, and I used RHEL back at my, at one job ago. I used RHEL, like as the main administrator. That was my job. So I kind of wanted to see, and that was like version 5 and 5.5 and so on, if I recall correctly. And so I decided I would like to check back in with them and see what was going on with Seven. So I got a self-support license. It's cheap. It's like $50. I didn't obviously want to get like a real version of it. In terms of like telephone support, 24/7, that kind of thing. That's not what I need. But I wanted to get a license primarily because I wanted to see what the registration process was like, or rather the subscription process was like, because my initial experience with it was not all that great back in RHEL 5. Now, in RHEL 5, you have to keep in mind that that was my first experience with any kind of subscription service for a Linux distribution. I'd never done that before, but the organization that was using it wanted support, or rather I wanted support, so I told them that they needed to pay, like, $250 or whatever it was for the year. I mean, it's nothing looking back at it for phone support. And so I'd never really had that experience. And when I installed, I remember like there being sort of this really surprising lack of, okay, let's get you all signed up now. And it almost felt like it was never going to ask me. And then the minute I went to do a Yum update, it said, oh, you don't have access to this RHN server. RHN being Red Hat Network, I think. So, and then I had to step back and learn about how to marry that computer with the online subscription tracker. And it was surprisingly, I felt like for someone who just kind of like wandered into the online store and purchased the box off the shelf and said, okay, now I've got Red Hat and I'm going to go home and install it, or go to work and install it. It was not very user friendly. I mean, it really kind of left me out in the lurch, and I didn't feel like that should have been happening, because I'm not a newcomer to Linux. So I was a little bit surprised by that. And I have to say that RHEL 7 has not changed that at all. It seems to have made the effort to change that, but it didn't quite hit its mark. So here's what happened. So I got the ISO from the server, put it in the computer that I was going to install it onto, installed it, and during the install process, again, there was no real mention of, you've purchased this thing, let's get you all subscribed, but I kind of expected that, because if you think about it, if you're an admin at a, big data center, you don't want to be registering as you're installing. You want to install it on your 8 servers or your 50 servers or whatever and walk away, have a couple of cups of coffee, and then come back and then deal with it. So I wasn't surprised by that. But afterwards, like the first launch thing, I mean, that I'm kind of used to a very quick Anaconda experience, and it was quite nice. It was very quick, very, very simple. And it installed, and then it rebooted, and I came back to the computer, sat down for the first launch sign up thing, and you create your user and all that other stuff. And one of the questions on the Red Hat one that I'd never seen on the Fedora first launch was, of course, do you want to register? And I thought, okay, well, registering sounds like something I would want to do. I paid this $50 self-support license for access to the RHN servers and for online, access to their knowledge base or something like that. I don't really know. Again, I didn't really do it for the, I don't actually need any of this stuff. It's solely to keep up with what's going on, because I've been writing a lot of articles about a lot of different things, and continuing my knowledge of RHEL seems like it's a good idea. So I figured, okay, I'll register. And so I clicked to register, and it fails because I've not agreed to the terms and conditions. And I thought, well, okay, that's fine. Show me the terms and conditions. No button to show me the terms and conditions. I was perplexed. So it asks me to register. It never shows me any terms and conditions. And then it fails because I haven't agreed to the terms and conditions, which it has not shown me. And there is apparently no way, unless I just missed it, but I could not find a button anywhere that would show me the terms and conditions that I could agree to and then continue to register. I filed a bug about it, but I haven't checked in lately to see if it's been addressed or if I'm wrong or whatever, but yeah, that was weird. So I continued, I just skipped the registration, continued signing in and on, and started Red Hat Desktop, and I ended up having to register manually, just through one of the interfaces. Now, to make things more confusing, there's two different ways to register at this point. There's a RHN Classic, and like then there's the new one. Like, I forget what they call it. Like, something, you know, probably with the word cloud in it. Not really. But yeah, so there's two different ways to do it. So I was really a little bit nervous about, okay, which way should I, how do I do that? Like, which one should I use? So I ended up, honestly, it took me about 3 tries because I kept getting it wrong. And actually, when I say that there are 3 ways, I should say that there are like 4 ways, because like 2 ways are there on your desktop, and then there's like some other way you can sign in online and you can register them from the website. But I still don't understand how the website knows the computer and how the computer knows the web. You know, and there was this token, and I tried copying it and pasting it in, and then it told me that I was already registered. So then I went to go to do Yum Update, and it didn't work again. In short, I literally had to reinstall to get myself out of that mess. And then there was this other mess that I, you know, between the online thing and the token and me already being registered and yet not registered. It took me about 3 installs to get this thing right, which, you know, was really surprising. And what's really surprising is that there's no, like, when you buy the stupid thing, it's just like, they're assuming that you know everything, apparently, because there's nothing there that says, okay, here's what you're going to get. Here's what you need to do. And even during the install process, there's nothing saying, at this point, you're going to have to register. If you've not read the terms and conditions, go to a different computer that has the internet on it, read the terms and conditions, and I don't know, go online maybe and click agree. I don't really understand where those terms and conditions are even. I never did see terms and conditions, just for the record. I did register, I got access to the RHN, never saw terms and conditions. So whatever that's worth, I don't know. So anyway, point being, is that the Red Hat subscription process needs a little bit of help, I think. I understand that for admins who have been doing Red Hat for forever, probably are very familiar with all this stuff, and they probably think it's really, really simple. But in terms of like a new sysadmin who's just trying it out from nothing, it was a really poor experience. And that's from someone who voluntarily paid $50 just to check in with the thing. I mean, I think if you're looking for a hard sell, I'm not that guy. I purchased the thing voluntarily. I was just gonna do an innocent little install to experience, you know, the out of the box RHEL experience so that I could praise it. So I could say how great it was and how easy it was and how this was Linux, subscription Linux done, you know, really, really well. And there's no excuse for people to say that Linux doesn't have support. You know, and it really, really surprised me. So that's sort of like the, that was a little bit surprising to me. A little bit upsetting in a way. You know, I didn't expect that. So that was that. On the flip side of all of this stuff, the Red Hat desktop experience is amazing. After you get past the subscription stuff, and obviously if you're just doing this for fun at home, you would not probably have purchased the $50 license, maybe. You'd probably be going with CentOS or Scientific Linux. But if not, once you get past the registration stuff, then once you log into the desktop, it's just utterly, utterly beautiful. And it's GNOME 3, which, as you know, I like GNOME 3. I'm fine with GNOME 3. Although, funny story about that in a minute. But there's a GNOME 3 desktop, but it's this amazingly sort of gorgeous new GNOME 3 that I'd never seen before. First of all, the bars at the top and the bottom were not black. They were gray. Which, I mean, that's kind of boring, actually, but it looked really nice. I was like, wow, GNOME 3 with gray bars instead of black bars, that's cool. Which is silly, because, you know, black bars is really cool, actually, and they're much better, but this looked different, so I thought it was cool. But the thing is that there's a bar at the top and there's a bar at the bottom. And I don't need 2 bars in real life, but I just thought that was interesting. And I thought, wow, this looks like a really traditional desktop. And so then I click on, like, there's an applications menu up at the top, if I recall correctly. And you click on that, and it's got, like, this really kind of cool sort of cinnamon or elementary OS kind of drop down menu, and it's like a really nice menu. You know, it's not like a boring XFCE kind of like here's a drop down menu. It's like a drop down menu with like a little arrow at the top that shows you where it's dropping down from, silly stuff like that. But it looks neat. It looks very slick and modern. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. This is like a really heavily modified GNOME 3. And it already had like the close, minimize, maximize buttons on the windows. I was just really, really impressed. And it turns out I thought it was like this must be like GNOME 3.8 or something. Like, so this must be the most recent GNOME, which is silly to assume because RHEL is famous for being behind things like Fedora. It turns out it was just GNOME 3 Classic. Now, I remember the days when GNOME 3 Classic meant you failed. Like, that was a punishment. Like, you had a computer that couldn't handle GNOME 3. And I remember, like, and you probably remember, you would log in to GNOME excitedly to experience GNOME 3, and the thing that they chose to show people that with computers that couldn't handle all the compositing glory of GNOME 3 was a frowny face. Like, it was a little monitor with a sad face on it that said GNOME 3 failed to start or something like that. It was like the most depressing, scary, frightening, horrific greeting that they could have ever possibly, you know, it wasn't like a cheerful little monitor that says, "Good news, you can't do compositing, but we've got a great desktop for you anyway." You know, it was like, "Eh, your computer failed, you failed, GNOME 3 will not play with you." You know, it was the worst. I hated that message. I could not stand that message. And this GNOME 3 Classic is really, really nice. This is not the old GNOME Classic of failure. This is a really, really nice GNOME 3. So if you hate GNOME 3, which I do not, if you do, you should go and check out GNOME 3 Classic, the new version, because it is really, really slick looking. It looks professional, it looks clean, it looks really flashy without being overly flashy. And honestly, after I used it for a couple of days, I was kind of sold on it. I thought this has everything that GNOME 3 has going for it, like all the fancy effects and kind of like some of the nice, you know, like the sliding in dock and the sliding in workspaces, I think, or did it have workspaces at the bottom? I don't remember. But it had some of the things that you like about GNOME 3. This, you know, it's sort of the cool looking new Nautilus windows and stuff like that, without any of the annoying things that drives you crazy. Like if you accidentally hit the bottom, you know, right corner, all your windows fly into expose mode or whatever, or whatever drives you nuts about GNOME 3, or if you accidentally mindlessly hit the super key, you know, you get a list of all the applications on your system, including all the ugly ones that didn't ever switch over from PNG icons, you know, 32 by 32 PNGs to SVG. So you've got these pixelated ugly things. And you've got all the repetition. You know how some applications they list themselves like four times for no reason? Yeah, so whatever drove you crazy about GNOME 3, GNOME 3 Classic does not have it. Frankly, it's a lot like the Cinnamon desktop experience if you've ever used Cinnamon desktop, which, funny story about that. So a friend of mine recently started using Linux, not so much by choice, but you know, things worked out and she had to start using Linux. And the desktop that I figured I should give her for no good reason was Cinnamon. And it turns out that Cinnamon's quite a nice desktop. And again, you know I'm no fan of the GNOME series. I'm not like a GNOME 2 must live forever kind of person. In fact, I hated GNOME 2. But the Cinnamon desktop's really nice. It is a lot like GNOME Classic, GNOME 3 Classic actually. And it's just really, really, really quite nice. You should try it if you are one of those people who like loved GNOME 2 and thought that was the way that all desktops should always be. Either GNOME 3 Classic or Cinnamon. Cinnamon is really, really nice, and they have it for Fedora. So if you are like me and just can't stop using Fedora on your desktop or whatever, then it's here for you, Cinnamon. And it's really, really nice. And I'm using Plank as the dock, which I have over on the left-hand side of the screen where docks are supposed to be. And it's a really nice desktop experience actually. It's got a lot of different themes that you can use with it. And it's just kind of, it gives you really most of what you expect. The one downside of Cinnamon is that the movie previews, like the icons for movie files, don't seem to get preview icons very frequently. And I don't know if that's just something that I need to make happen. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it manually, but maybe there's like some kind of plugin that I need to install. I'm not sure. But yeah, it's a pretty slick desktop, and I kind of fell into using it on this desktop machine, and just never really got around to not using it. So yeah, it's serving me well, I guess. And I had never used it before. I really am only using it because my friend is using Cinnamon, and I want to have a desktop that is similar to hers, so that when something horrible goes wrong, I can either see if that's happening on my computer or if it's just on her computer or whatever. So yeah, Cinnamon desktop is quite nice. The Mocha icon set is quite nice, MOKA, and certainly Plank. It's a really nice dock. Definitely the best dock for Linux that I have yet experienced. And I've tried them all. And I'm not crazy about docks, but this one is not an annoying dock. It's really a very usable and capable little dock that acts pretty much exactly as you would expect it. I don't know exactly why it took so long for it to come into existence, but it is really, really nice. Okay, so that's the good things about RHEL 7, I guess, and the bad things. RHEL 7 in general, using it as an everyday desktop, I have to say I'm not using it as an everyday desktop at this point. I had to ditch it. Not really because of anything that it did, it's just, it's too soon. Because there are, see, the way that the Red Hat world works, as far as I can tell, is that there's obviously Red Hat, CentOS, Scientific Linux, whatever ripoff of RHEL that you can imagine. And they're there and they're stable and that's attractive and appealing to me. And then there's Fedora and it's crazy and wild and unstable. And that's appealing to the sort of the sadistic side of me, or is it masochistic? I don't know, whatever, side of me. Yeah, masochistic, I think. Anyway, that's appealing, but you know, I do like the stability. So, I was messing around, you know, seeing if RHEL was a possibility. And one of the things about like the stable side of things is that the repositories really take a long time to catch up. I'm talking extra repositories here. Obviously, the RHEL, the RHN server repositories, they're fine. They're up to speed. If that's what you're using it for, then that's great. But for anything else, you really kind of have to wait around for like RPM Fusion or some really RPM Fusion, and EPEL exists, but it doesn't have quite as much as RPM Fusion does. So yeah, it's really for someone like me who likes to play with media and games and programming and, you know, all the fun stuff of computing, it kind of, it's not really that hot for all that stuff. And I'm not sure what exactly that means, like, in terms of, could you recommend it to a friend as an everyday desktop? Even, I mean, just saying, okay, a friend of mine wants to switch to Linux, I want them to have something that's stable, that they're not gonna have to upgrade every 6 months. I mean, that kind of solidly puts you outside of the Red Hat / Fedora / whatever, that continent, that globe, it kind of just, it displaces you. Because if you go with Fedora, you've got this distribution that's going to become end-of-lifed in about a year. I think 18 months is the longest a Fedora release has been supported for. And there's actually a special interest group out there in the Fedora camp that is kind of campaigning for an extended life release, but it's not a thing yet. So yeah, I think Fedora, like the longest really support you're gonna have is, I think it's been 18 months is the longest that one has lasted. And that's not very long for a normal computer user. I mean, think about the people, well, I don't even have to say about Windows XP. I mean, that's the sort of classic example, but I mean, even you know, even that one notwithstanding, there are people on very, very old releases of certain operating systems. And that should be a thing. That really, really should be. And for that, RHEL really, really, really does seem attractive in CentOS and Scientific Linux and stuff. It's a really, that's a great thing. But at the same time, it takes a while for the repositories to catch up. So you have to kind of wait for that to happen. And once that happens, I think you're okay. But it doesn't quite feel like it has that balance to me. It's like it's either very, very conservative or very, very crazy. There's not really that middle of the road red hat place. And I could be mistaken. Maybe if I gave it, maybe if I really took a long time to settle in to RHEL or CentOS or something, maybe I would find that middle ground. And right now for myself, I find that middle ground with Fedora, and I just install it, and I don't update that often. I update security only, and that works for me. And that's okay. But I don't know. In my mind, I keep thinking, what is that middle ground where I do get like a 3 or 4 year release of, you know, or supported release of a Red Hat-ish distribution. And maybe that's like, maybe what I'm really looking for is like Magia or something like that. I can't really think. Well, maybe even OpenSUSE. I don't know what their track record is. So, I mean, there are other ones out there, and the only reason I haven't really gone in those directions is because, well, frankly, I don't really have the time to, you know, sort of distro hop. I feel like I'm past that stage of my Linux life, but I mean, I could for fun. I could check out other things and kind of really get invested in them and really, really try to produce the stuff that I want to produce on those distributions. But at this point, I don't really see that happening for myself anytime soon. I mean, I'm a little bit too busy doing fun stuff on the stuff that I know. But I don't know. It may be like Magia or PC Linux OS or some distribution like that. Or it might not be in the Red Hat universe at all. You know, they do have their thing. They've got their, we're going to develop here and we're going to be stable here. I mean, that's their thing. They're very stable or they're very cutting edge. So quite possibly what I'm looking for is Debian. That comes immediately to mind is Debian. But again, I don't see myself anytime soon branching off to actually figure that out. But it's just something that I've noticed about the Red Hat thing, really. That's kind of like, that's what I'm looking at. And, I don't know. If you've got something middle of the road that you think is a great new Linux distribution, let me know, because I'm curious as to what people are using these days to fill that slot. I mean, Slackware, honestly, is my go-to for everything in real life, but I'm just wondering what else there is in other universes. So feel free to let me know what you're using. It must be time for Noob Corner. So Noob Corner, I still don't know if this is actually going to be a long-lasting feature on this show or not, but why not throw it in there, because I do have something to talk about. And this is, I guess it's, you know, technically for new users, but it could really be for anyone, because honestly, I didn't really, really get this myself until really, really recently. A friend of mine recently has been using Linux as the primary desktop a lot more lately, and she asked me how to make special characters in Linux, and certainly on the old OS that I and this person was had come from, there was this, you know, secret sort of like no one knew about it unless you knew about it kind of thing, but you hit Option and then some other key and that gave you special characters, and that's all anyone in that world knows them as. They're just special characters. You don't really know the difference between ASCII and Unicode, because, you know, that's information. Why would anyone promote the distribution of actually useful generic information in a community. So option, you know, I don't know, 8, I think it was, maybe, would give you a bullet, like a round bullet point. Option E would give you an E with an acute accent over it. I don't know, option something else would give you something else. That was the special characters on this operating system. That was what I was used to. So even when I sort of finally figured out how to do special characters on Linux through the compose key, I in my mind it was always hit the compose key and some other key together and then hit some other key. And I'd been doing that for quite some time, and I guess for whatever reason it worked for the couple of times that I needed it. And to be honest, I've written so many things in markup and markdown lately. Well, mostly markup, to be honest. I've been writing in markdown as well, but this, what I'm saying, applies to the markup. It's that I just haven't needed special characters in real time. Everything that I've been doing with special characters, I've been doing in markup language, and so it's, you know, you give it something, you know, like ampersand, but I have to type it, ampersand hash 58 semicolon would give you a colon. Ampersand hash, I don't know, 91 semicolon gives you a left square bracket, and so on. So I'd really fallen out of the habit of typing in special characters in real time on Linux. Well, now I know how to do that, and you can get really cool characters like a bullet or an E with either an acute or a grave or a pound or a euro symbol or a trademark symbol. I mean, a heart, a happy face, all kinds of cool things, and even fractions. This was cool too. I mean, like 1/2 or 3/4, you can get, you know, traditionally you would just type in, I guess, 1/ or ampersand hash 47 semicolon, 1/2 or 1/4, whatever. Don't have to do that anymore. You've got these special keys now called multi-keys or compose keys. So here's how to do all that. So with a compose key, you define some key on your keyboard as a kind of a trigger, is how I think of it. And so the sequence is that you hit the compose key, and then you hit some other key, and then another modifier key. And they usually make some kind of sense. So, for instance, for a bullet point, it's compose key, and then a dot, and then the equal sign. So that's three key presses that you've just done, but if you think about it, it makes sense. The compose key, or the multi-key, puts you into kind of like special mode, and then the dot and the equal sign, if you think about what those two things are, you got a dot is like a dot, and then the equal sign, it kind of happens on the middle of a line, so put those together, you kind of get a bullet point. Or a multi-key, and then the less than sign, and then the number 3 gives you a heart, because of course the popular shorthand for a heart in text is less than, and then the 3. The copyright symbol, for example, I think is like multi-key C and then O, or O and then C, I forget which, but that kind of thing. You know, they've got a certain mnemonic, can kind of remember them in that way. So that's nice. That's cool. And it actually is a lot more flexible than the old OS, because you have a lot more possibilities. If you've got three, or rather two key presses, you know, I mean, technically you have three because you have to put yourself into multi-mode or compose mode, whatever that special mode is called. But then you get, you know, you have a key and then some modifier key rather than just option pressing, you know, option key, option key, option key, where you really only have one possible result of that key combination. So I personally use the, and this is up to you, this compose key or multi-key. There seem to be two words for it, either compose or multi. It's both apparently the same thing. This can of course be any key that you want. There is this weird key on most of the PC keyboards that I have encountered that I'd never seen before on my old OS, and it's a menu key. It's over on the right-hand side. And it's usually right between, like, the super key, which is, you know, the Windows key, or the Ubuntu key on System 76 laptops, and the control key. So there's this menu key, and I really don't know what the menu key is for. I mean, one would think that it would trigger, like, a menu or something, but it's never done anything for me on any Linux that I've ever installed, or maybe I just never noticed it. I don't know. But I make that into my compose key or my multi key. The standard kind of thing applies in terms of setting the key preferences. And of course, depending on what desktop you use, that could be done in a couple of different ways. I know that on KDE, for instance, you go to input, well, you go to system settings, first of all, and then you go to input devices, and then the top selection on the left for input devices, you'd go to keyboard, and then there are three tabs in there, last I checked. There's hardware, layouts, and advanced. So if you go to the advanced, and you go into this compose key position section, then you'll see that there's a bunch of different things that you could map your compose key to. One would be a caps lock key, but I use that as my as an extra control key for Emacs. And there's like a left win key, like that would be your left Windows key. I could use that too, I guess, but I just got into the habit of using menu. You could do a pause, you could do print screen, which I don't know why you'd want to do that. I would think that you'd want to use print screen for printing screens. Right alt, you could use an alt key or the control on the right side. You know, lots and lots of different ways to do that. And so you map it to one of those keys, and that becomes your multi-key or your compose key. On GNOME, it's really similar. It's like in system settings, and then you go to keyboard, and then there's like this little button that says options. It's kind of hiding down on the lower right hand, and you go to options, and then you'll find it in there. It's, I don't know, distressingly hidden on GNOME, to be honest. But on Cinnamon, I think it's similar to GNOME, but I think it's a little bit different. But you get the idea. It's somewhere in your system settings around where you would set up your keyboard layouts and stuff like that. Now, if you're on a desktop that doesn't have a system settings, like Fluxbox, as I use at work, then you can obviously just do it with Xmod Map. You can launch Zev, X-E-V, and position your mouse in a little box and press the menu key and then look in your terminal, and you'll see that it's telling you what key code you've just pressed. And so for the menu key on, I think, most keyboards that I find, it's the key code 135. That's just, I've got one Xmod map file, and it's pretty much, I don't remember ever changing it from 135. So that seems to be fairly standard. So it's 135, and you just do key code space 135 space equals space multi underscore key. And that sets your menu key to the multi-key. That's about it, I think. Then you do, of course, xmod map space tilde slash dot xmod map. And that the dot xmod map file should be with a capital X, I think. At least that's what I do it as. So there you go. There's your xmod map file. It's got key code 135. I would probably make that happen when you first, you know, in your init file for Fluxbox or startup file, whatever it is, you know, trigger it in some fashion so that you don't have to do it manually. And that'll turn your menu key into your compose key. And then, as I say, all you have to do to actually use it is try it out. Just hit, you know, go to... So a couple of disclaimers here. First of all, you need to be in an application that will... That can recognize all these super fancy characters. And a really good one just to start, you know, as a test would be something like LibreOffice. Possibly AbbeyWord, but certainly LibreOffice. That's kind of like, I would probably go, I would default to that first, I think. Because that, you just, you know that's going to going to work. The one thing that you should look out for in addition to that is what font you're using, and that will matter. If you've got some kind of crazy tricked out system where you've set lots of different fonts for yourself and you're using a lot of non-standard things, then you might want to think about maybe just using something really, really simple and common just for your initial test, because you don't want to do what I did, which I think I tried doing this in like a little terminal that's using like a bitmapped font or something. I mean, it was completely ridiculous. I mean, I couldn't figure out why wasn't it working? Why isn't this thing triggering my special characters? And I spent way too long on this. It was quite embarrassing, actually. And then it turns out, of course, that it's literally a bitmapped font, and it didn't have Unicode stuff in it. It's a terminal font. So don't do that. Just open up like Abbey Word or LibreOffice or whatever, and then press your compose key, and then, for instance, dot equals, and you should see a bullet point. Menu, and then apostrophe E should give you an E with a little accent over it. Menu, and then caret, that's the little pointy hat over the 6, and then the E should give you an E with a little acute symbol over it. Menu, comma, C should give you the C with a cedilla under it, or whatever it's called. So yeah, Unicode, my friend, it's 3 buttons away. It's 3 key presses away. Really, really simple, sublimely flexible, really, really nice. It's not like a shift key. You don't hit shift apostrophe E, or, you know, like menu apostrophe E. It's menu and then apostrophe and then E, or menu apostrophe and then O, or, you know, menu tilde N, and so on. And try them all out. It's really a lot of fun, and you can amaze your friends with all the cool little things you've got. Now, you can look at all the different combinations that you have available to you in /usr/share/x11/locale/en_us.utf-8/compose, or thereabouts. It may be different on different systems. It just kind of depends. That's what you're looking for. The key term there, I think, is compose, really. So you could do like a find, maybe. Or you could even just poke around online. There's a couple of different places online that just kind of lists them for you. It's not impossible to find, so just look around and you'll see them. And that's it. Okay, this is the final show of the season, so I guess it's time to sort of wrap up all the different Python stuff that we started. This isn't really wrapping anything up, because I'm sure I'm going to continue talking about Python in the next season from time to time, but this is certainly the wrap-up of the concentrated Python stuff. And in this case, one of the things that I feel like I might as well get to, even though in real life, I mean, it, obviously, and this is kind of the hard thing about doing a lot of, like, programming lessons over the course of a podcast, and something that I didn't really think of this, you know, when I started, and I used to kind of complain to myself that other, you know, there had been some podcasts in the past that were about ostensibly just programming, you know. I mean, it was kind of like Learn Python, that kind of podcast, and it's really weird how bad they were, and how badly I wanted to listen to them and learn, and it's just, you know, it's if you're doing a podcast, then you're doing a podcast. And if you want to read a book on programming, then you need to read a book on programming. And if you want an audiobook of that book on programming, then that's a whole other thing aside from just doing a podcast. Because as I believe I said, and I think probably many of you probably felt this way too, like for a while, once we started getting into the deeper side of building little Python games and stuff, I mean, it was just me reading code over, you know, it's just like the logic and the help, the usefulness of that sort of, it actually starts to sabotage itself, because it's actually very not helpful for me to just read out strings of code that doesn't act, you know, you're not writing it down as I talk, so what's the point? So one of the things about doing a podcast and doing programming lessons on the podcast has been that, obviously, I don't know where you are in your practice. If you're just starting out with this stuff, sure, if you've been writing Python along with me this entire time, then you may be ready for what I'm about to tell you. And if not, then this is going to be a little bit on the advanced side, and you might not be ready for it anytime soon. That said, my example is going to be very simple, and so you could literally sit down and do this. You know, you could do this example with me, and or, you know, whatever. And you'll see the usefulness of it. You'll see the concept, and then later, as you continue to program, you will probably remember this episode, and you will think, okay, I need to go back now and find out how to do this thing. So this thing that I'm talking about is writing modular code. This is a little bit like what I was talking about with artists and all the different assets that they use. In programming, a lot of times there are external assets that you need to use. Now in Python, we've already talked about this a little bit. You know, whenever you import a Pygame module the Pygame module, you're importing all these different classes and methods from this collection of stuff that some people wrote, and they put the label Pygame on it. And when you install that, it's going into your file system, into /, well, it depends on what kind of system you've got, but you know, it's ending up with a bunch of other Python stuff. It's PyShared or Python 2.7/, you know, whatever. Just kind of depends on your system. But yeah, it's getting installed into some shared location on your hard drive. And then Python knows where to find it, because there's this environment variable called Python path. And so it knows exactly where to look for when you say things like import Python, Pygame or PyCute or whatever it is that you're importing. So those are kind of like shared assets. Now, the neat thing about that, Well, so this is, obviously this branches out more than just with Python, right? I mean, if you're doing C++, you're doing includes at the top of your application, and those includes, again, they're reaching out into some shared location. They're literally importing a header file into your code, and it's making it part of your program. You're just using shared, I shouldn't say shared in that context, but yeah, you're using common assets on the system. So the cool thing about, and that's very modular. So the cool thing about that is Python, in Python, if you're starting to use Python a lot, you can make your own little modules. You can split out a bunch of different functions into different files. And that way, well, first of all, it makes a lot of your code sometimes a little bit more readable, because, for instance, if you've got this program, well, for instance, in the case of Planter, I wanted Planter, the Slacker Media project creator, to be usable either as a shell command or as a GUI, because I have no real interest in doing one and not the other, you know, for something like that. Planter, I wanted it to be quote unquote user friendly. I really want it to be user friendly. So I wanted it to be a GUI application for people who want something GUI, and I wanted it to be useful for people who would just rather do it quickly on the command line. So I have a file that, you know, when you start Planter one way or another, this file is the thing that gets executed, and it checks for the GUI flag. And if the GUI flag is detected, then it attempts to import PyQt, and then it attempts to import PySide, if PyQt isn't found. And if PySide isn't found, that means you have no GUI to import, and so it starts running from the shell anyway. Now, if you start up Planter and do not issue the GUI command, or the flag, then it just runs in the shell. So it's got, and if it does have PyQt and PySide, then it does obviously run as a GUI application. So you've got all those different options open to you, and the way that those are open is because this initial file that you execute, all it does is it looks at the different options, the arguments that you've passed when you launch the program, and we've done that before with the opts parse module, or arg parse module rather. And that's great. That works. That's an easy way to grab options. And then we analyze it. And then if the user chooses one thing, we send them in one direction off to some other file. And if they choose a different thing, then we send them off into this other direction using this other file. And that's a great reason to have modular code, because if you didn't have the modular code, then you're writing, you know, sort of like two different potential pathways all into one file, and that can get very confusing after a while once you start reading it over. Plus, in many cases, like, there would be no reason to, like, you can reuse a bunch of that different stuff. Like, my GUI module, the GUI side of the application essentially is just gathering information so that the shell version of it can run in the background, process the information, and then finish up. You know, I mean, that's all that really needs to happen. So modular code is a good thing. It's essential in many, many cases, because like I say, you can't, you know, if you write this great set of little functions in Python and it's all in one big, huge, gargantuan file, someone can't just now import your cool code and use all your functions, because you don't have modules. It's all one big behemoth. But if you split it out into different modules, then someone else could possibly use one of those modules for something that they are writing. I mean, in some cases, I think it's probably too specific to actually be useful, but you never know. So yeah, modular code is a good thing. It's good for lots of different reasons. And, it's not really that hard to do, to be honest. It's surprisingly simple. There are one or two little catches that you have to sort of look out for, but I'll give you a heads up about them. So let's just say that let's do something not modular first. So we just do /user /bin/on/Python import sys, and we'll do an if sys.argv 1 equals string 1. Then we'll say that the variable arg equals sys.argv1, and then we'll print arg so that we know where we are, and then we'll print you chose path 1. And then we'll do else arg equals sys.argv1, print arg, and print you chose path 2. So that's a non-modular implementation. If I launch my little program test.py with a number 1 after test.py, then it tells me you chose path 1. And if I launch it with 2, 3, 4, 5, 0, anything but 1, then it'll tell me you chose path 2. And that's obviously in no way modular. It's all in one big file. So the way to make all of this modular would be to create, for instance, let's create a directory, and we'll call it pathways, because we're just sending the people down, our user down one or another path. So we'll call it pathways, and we'll move our little test document into pathways. We'll call it path.py. So move path.py into /pathways. And now we'll cd into pathways. And the one thing that we need to do in our little pathways, this is our basically our Python library directory. The one thing that we need to do is let Python know that, hey, this is a location for Python modules. And the way that you do that is you have an empty file called __init__.py in a folder. So if you just literally just, if you're in your pathways directory or whatever directory you want to make into a, you know, Python module directory, you can just touch space __init__.py, and now Python will know that this is a valid place to import stuff from. Okay, so the way to make all of this work is you would create, for instance, a file. We could call it 1.py, and this will be our little our one function. And we could say obviously shebang /user/bin/onv python, and we'll do a def greet --:, and then print you chose path 1, and that's all we need for that file. And we'll do the same thing for 2.py, and we just do def greet --:, print you chose path 2. Okay, so obviously in a bigger, more complex application, this would be full of a lot more exciting stuff than just that, but that's what we'll do for this example. Now we would need to then modify our initial our path.py file, the actual one that gets executed. And for that, we'll reopen that. And right now it just says if sysargv equals 1, then print you chose path 1, else print you chose path 2. So the first thing we'll do is import, we imported sys for our sys arguments. So we'll import 1 and we'll import 2. So notice that I'm not saying import 1.py. I'm just saying import 1. Or import 2. So that's that. And then we'll do the same if-else block. It'll just be if sysargv1 equals string 1, arg equals sysargv1, print arg. Now instead of saying print you chose path 1, we'll just say 1.greet --:. And the same thing for 2. Else argv equals sysargv1, print arg, and then 2.greet --:. So all we're doing here is we're invoking, you know, 1, and within the 1 file we are calling the greet function, so 1.greet. Now we could get around that, you probably know, by importing 1, from 1 import all, or rather star, or you could say import 1 as, you know, whatever, but here we're just doing it this way so that you understand where greet comes from. So it's 1.greet --:. And it's that simple. That's you're suddenly using modular code because you're actually executing path.py, but you're importing into it the functions 1 and 2. And depending on what user input you get, you're executing either 1 or 2. Now the one I would say the thing to keep in mind here is, I mean, as always, you have to kind of track where your data is coming from and where it's going, because obviously if we did it a little bit more complex and we wanted our 1.py, instead of just saying print you chose 1, we wanted it to actually print, you know, reprint the input data that the user gave us. Or import 2, you know, print you chose path 2, maybe we want to print out what the user did give us. Because, I mean, 1, they gave us 1, but if, you know, the else statement's pretty broad, so we could say something like, you did not choose path 1, you chose path, and then whatever they inputted. Now for that, of course, I mean, in our path.py, we have this arg thing that we grabbed from sys.argv. So when we say to greet, how could we get arg into the to function? And that's your cue to remember all of the lessons in previous episodes about self and even class and things like that, and how to jockey data between those different things. So you would probably know that, for instance, to get, you know, we're getting this arg variable from the input of the user. So that's a known thing. So we've got arg equals, for instance, in the else one, where it's very broad. So we're going to tell people what they entered. If they did not enter one, we'll tell them what they entered. So we could say, okay, arg equals six, sysarg of one. I mean, we don't actually have to assign the variable. I mean, that variable actually exists. But I do it just for shorthand. So arg equals sysarg of one. And then we can print arg, sure, who cares. And then 2.greet paren arg. Paren. So now we're sending this argument variable through the portal into 2.greet. Now obviously if we then execute 2.greet and we hand it arg and it doesn't know what to do with arg, it's going to error out. In fact, you could try that now. You could say, okay, Python pathway.py 2 or 3 or, you know, anything but 1, and it'll give you an error. It'll say def greet takes one argument or takes 0 arguments and you've given me 1. Or something like that. So in 2.py, you would have to change the def greet paren paren colon to def greet paren arg, or some term, but just for clarity and consistency, we'll use the same term. So def greet paren arg paren colon, and then print you chose path, comma arg. Or something like that, and now it knows what arg is. You can call that variable from within that function, and it will actually work. And again, you can actually try that, and you will find that yes, it does work, which is nice. So that's how to write modular code. The main thing, like I say, to keep in mind is the underscore underscore init underscore underscore dot py. That's a thing. You have to, you know, if you start getting pretty fancy with your Python stuff, and it's an installable thing that people can install in their systems, you kind of have to tell your Python code where to look for its Python modules. And then finally, for the modular thing, you need to tell it where to, you need to tell the folder that contains your modules that yes, you're a module folder. You have modules inside of you. It's underscore underscore init underscore underscore dot py. And it's just an empty file. You just touch it. It's there. And that is about it. So feel free to go look at the Planter code. I mean, it's not super sophisticated, but it does happen to be modular, which is why I'm referencing it. And it's got a good little launch script that actually gets executed when you run Planter. That I totally ripped it off from Flowblade. And it's a good way of managing things, and it adds to your environment or something, the Python, the applicable Python path. So there's that, and then there's another one that I wrote for a class on Python programming that I taught at one point called Retten, R-E-T-T-E-N. It's on my Getorious.org page under the MakerBox project. It's a silly little rot encoder application. It's not a big deal in terms of what it actually does. It's just in terms of showing people how to be modular. That's its main purpose. So you can look at that as well. So yeah, take a look at it. Try out some modular Python stuff. It's pretty cool. That's, I think, about all I have for this episode, to be honest. Next season, we're going to talk about, you know, more of the same, a lot of technology, probably a little bit more programming. I have some compiler stuff that I want to talk about at some point, multimedia, you know, the usual. And yeah, thank you all for your feedback and for your tips and your tricks and your critique and for listening and for sticking with me all the way through 9 seasons. And let's get ready for the 10th.
stone thingy. And then there's like the Twin Cities with their weird zoop loopy thing. Forget about the rest of the Midwest, it sucks. Then it's like, oh yeah, the Grand Canyon. Oh yeah, the Statue of Liberty. All these different parts of different areas of the coast. There's all these images. It's like somewhat like a mythology because we never actually see it.